Live from Los Angeles, this is LA Talk Radio, broadcasting for the seventh year.
You're listening to All About Guitar with Jeff Lowell, only on LA Talk Radio.
Amazing instrument. It has developed into an incredible voice in today's music. So many types of guitars, so many styles of playing, all sorts of gear. How does one make their voice be heard as a guitarist? My name is Jeff Floro, and welcome to All About Guitar, where we talk tone, we talk technique, we talk gear. Where we discover how we can become better musicians in a world of constantly changing technologies. Where we take a good look at everything guitar. And sometimes not exactly guitar, but just as important. So we can be more successful as a musician in today's music scene. So sit back and relax, and let's explore All About Guitar. Good evening, everybody. Welcome to All About Guitar. We have a full house in here tonight. It's been almost 2 years to the date that I had my very good friend I've known since childhood, Pat DiPuccio, known as the Pooch. We did a show about punk guitar on the Flow Guitar Enthusiast, and the response was amazing. Everybody loved it, and we had to do more. So this is the next series of it, the next segment, which we're going to focus on the UK scene, of the punk scene. Before I play the first clip, I just want to go around and introduce everybody that's here tonight. There's a group of people that are very, very important to the whole scene, and it's going to be an interesting show. Besides Pat DiPuccio, who's one of the founding editors and creators of Flipside Magazine, which pretty much documented everything, the punk movement, especially in Los Angeles, but the whole scene. And I remember, I was telling the people here before the show that I remember him bringing the print copies of it to Lovell's, which was our hangout in Whittier, where all the record store. And he was bringing these, like just carrying a bunch of them in there to sell over there. I remember that. So, but we've been friends, and he's been playing guitar for years and years and years. So he's here. He's playing. He's played in the Sloths, and he still does. And he's playing in the Condors. And tonight, and we at the end of the show, I'm going to play an exclusive clip from the Condors from their upcoming album that he brought in for me. It's a really cool song. You're going to really like it. Secondly, I'm very happy and honored to have in the studio Mick Rossi from Slaughter and the Dogs, which is considered one of the founding fathers of the punk rock movement. He's done all sorts of stuff. He's in presently with a band with Christopher Wicks called The Glorious. And I think their newest album is Stories from a Fractured Youth, if I'm correct.
That was the last one, yeah.
And then he's also an actor. I was reading his bio the other day. He's a script writer. He's a producer. He's done all sorts of cool stuff. So he's here today. I'm great. I'm happy to have him here. And then, of course, from the original show that was here 2 years ago, Prescott Niles from the Knack. He's here again. I had to call him up and have him just come down and hang with us.
I'm a fan.
And he was there. He was in the scene, and he saw the beginnings of it, too. So we're going to get...
Yeah, I caught in New York and England, and, you know.
So he's
always part of scenes.
But besides playing in the Knack, he's currently playing with Missing Persons, and he's been touring with them. And then also, two of my friends that I've known for years and years and years, and they're very dear to me, J.P. Duran and Lisa Carbe from Carbe and Duran and Incendio, two great musicians, great guitar players and bass players, and they're here too. And I just consider J.P. the encyclopedia of all things punk. And between him and Pooch.
That's shocking, yeah.
Well, you know more than me, but I'm just an old progger. But anyway, he and Pooch, last show, they just were just the information that was just coming out was amazing. And now with Mick, they've been talking before the show. We've been setting up, and it's just amazing. So we're going to get into that now. But first, what I want to do is
It's Mark Reback, drummer from Slaughter and the Dogs.
Yes, he's here too, and I'm very sorry, but I'm a senior. It's a senior moment.
I'm just happy to be in the room with all these people.
So what I'm going to do is I'm going to play a clip that I got from Slaughter and the Dogs, and this is an interesting case because there's some leads and fills in here besides the main song. This is called Rise and Fall of Babylon, and it's a really cool, we're going to talk about that because there's some interesting guitar sounds on it. So here's Slaughter and the Dogs. Now, that was it's just very cool. The lead was just killer. I got to know what you were using on there. I know it sounded like an Echoplex in there, but was that some type of phaser or something?
Yeah. I tell you what it is I have an old Color Sound wah-wah pedal.
I was going to say, it's got
everyone in the room.
Which was made by a company in England called Pi. It's that old. Mm-hmm. And it was given to me by Mick Ronson. And what Mick used to do when he was playing with David, he put a wider link in it, because if you look at a Crybaby wah-wah, it only opens this much.
Right.
So with the Color Sound, Mick put a wider link in it because it was all about that tone. Mm-hmm. So of course I copied him, and so it's an old Color Sound, and I used a Les Paul, but I used a tiny, tiny practice amp this big, and then I ran and I mic'd it with a Neumann. And then I ran it through a compressor and an Echoplex because I wanted this slight delay on to do this riff and then have a little spin on it. So
yeah, well, I remember a friend of mine has one, Jeff Muller, the dentist to the guitarist. He has a Color Sound, and it was always a kind of an interesting sound. I think you still turn me on with great when Greg Lake sang and Emerson Lake and Palmer, that wah-wah was that color because that filter was different than the traditional Crybaby Vox. It had a different sweep. But anyway, welcome everybody. It's just awesome to have all you guys here. And let's talk a little bit about the early days of Slaughter and the Dogs and how it how the scene. And all you guys chime in here in terms of how the scene started and what were the early roots and how it came together. And also, too, I want to try to, if we can define it, how to play that type of music. How is it different than some of the New York scene, the LA scene? So I'm going to throw that out to everybody. Go ahead.
Don't all look at me. Well, no, I mean, I was saying this earlier. Is a great thing about naivety because you don't know any better. You just you're operating on pure instinct and ambition. And certainly with the early days of Slaughter and the Dogs, that's what we were operating on. So we didn't really know enough about technique. We didn't know about equipment, but we had heart. And I think in anything you do, if you come from a place of honesty in your heart, somehow that can channel through into a feel.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you can do a simple A chord, but it's if it's played with heart and feel and you mean it, it just resonates. So the early punk scene, when we started in Manchester, it was just rallying for attention, driven by pure heart and ambition. Because we were super, super poor, too, you know, very, very working class families. In fact, the first demos we did, the steel grids on the street, we stole all the steel grids, the drainage grids, and took them to the scrap metal place to weigh in. for scrap metal, so we could have demo time.
Oh wow!
Yeah, and that was how we did. I mean, Noel Gallagher would understand that.
But your early days, what were you into? What were you listening to?
Oh man, it was. I just idolized Mick Ronson. I mean, I still do. He's my hero. And so I remember as a child seeing David Bowie on Top of the Pops, which was a very popular TV show, do Starman. And I really thought he was an alien. I didn't know. He shaved eyebrows and seeing this guy with red hair. And it just blew my mind. So, you know, we gravitated to that. Wayne Barrett, a singer of Slaughter, he was mad into Brian Ferry, and then T-Rex. Mm-hmm. And it was mainly those three for me, Bowie, T-Rex, and Roxy Music, you know.
Oh, wow.
For listeners to kind of contextualize, because I was talking with Pat earlier about what kind of was the setup. I'm a big Hendrix fan. I know Prescott is as well. For me, it was much later. It was something that was learned. Through reading and seeing all these things, it became obvious that all the bands we love, whether it was, you know, Zeppelin coming out and being really cool, or Free, or particularly The Who in England, you know, these were amazing bands. And in the United States, it would have been like the Stooges that had kind of a punk energy, or MC5, yeah, like proto-punk, like the beginning. So by the time 74, 75, 76 rolled around, a lot of those bands were spent. They were, you know, Hendrix was already dead. Zeppelin had come out with Physical Graffiti. Floyd had done, you know, a couple of them. A lot of bands had already made that statement. There were a lot of prog bands, Yes, and Genesis and all that. And outside of those bands that were maybe pushing the edge progressively, there was a whole group of disaffected people that had music that wasn't speaking to them. They weren't having bands that had a visceral reaction like the Stooges, like something primal, you know, something really, really basic and fundamental. So there's the notion of what, you know, I guess the question would be kind of what was happening in 74 and 75. And then kind of an interesting turning point, which is a good context, is what happened at Manchester Hall. We'll get to that.
Yeah.
But the thought before that, I mean, you know, did you coming out of that scene, did you see a similar thing where you didn't like kind of what was being presented? Because all of this happened right around the same time. The Ramones in New York, the English punk scene, and then West Coast were all emerging out of, like, I don't like this music anymore. This sucks. I don't dig it.
We're all part of the environment, you know. And as I was going to call this, I was going to say this is like a whole, you know, evening of mix. It's like, you know, in England, you had Mick Ronson and you had Mick Taylor and Mick Jones, eventually Mick Ralphs, and I even went to Mick Tucker, the Swede, who I really liked,
sure.
You know, and you know, but living where you live, you take what you can. And in England, the bands that were going on at the time that we kind of heard about maybe through Rock Scene magazine or Circus or Cream or whatever, you know, that influenced wherever you were from, you know.
Yeah.
And so anywhere you are, you take from that.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, it's interesting because we were talking before the show and Mick was saying, I mean, we you know, of course, Humble Pie had to come up, and we're both big fans of Humble Pie. That was like the real stuff to me.
Steve Marriott. Mr. Punk.
Yeah, but the thing was, is in terms of, and I was very fortunate to see The Who in their peak days of Who's Next and Quadrophenia when they were with Mooney. Yeah. And but it's interesting because, yes, at that time, a lot of the new rock acts that were coming out in the late 70s, early 80s, you had mentioned the influence of glam rock, but especially in the United States, it was kind of staged. It was kind of I'm not talking about Ronson.
Alice Cooper transcended all that.
Well, he was parodying everything. He was making fun of it. He was
but he knew where it was coming. He came from He came from a garage rock background too.
And for the context that we're going to talk about, it's all about the New York Dolls, because by then Iggy was kind of in and out of the scene, or in and out of like drug use, or all of his different bands and everything. So when you're talking about 71 to 73, even though there were, like, you know, glam bands and Big Boots, and certainly Bowie and Mick Ronson and all these things,
yeah,
the guys that were carrying the flag for most messed up and most like, yeah, just like on the edge were the New York Dolls, because they were, and they figure kind of prominently in the story of what ended up happening in Manchester later. The one of the contexts being, I will give this little story because this came out of Jelly Biafra, who was at the Dead Kennedys. He talks about being in Boulder, Colorado in 1976. And thinking it's very country, and all the women are dressed like Stevie Nicks, and all the guys look like they're in Free Fall, you know, and like Rick Rowan. And so, and they hear that this band is going to blow through town, and they think it's going to be kind of, this will be funny, right? And it turns out to be the Ramones. And they're all in the front row, and they're like, this band came on and blew everybody away, just like with their mouths agape. And he said, out of that show came the Dead Kennedys, Wax Trax, Ministry, like all these important, like some first, some second generation West Coast and United States acts came out of this. But even a more relevant version of that happened at Manchester Lesser Free Trade Hall in 1976. So you have the context of people are young people are generally not happy with the music. They're looking for something new. And the Sex Pistols do one show in Manchester at the first show that happened in early June. Mm-hmm. And then word spreads. And you know, certainly Sex and things were happening with London, but what happened at that trade hall directly involved you guys, Slaughter and the Dogs, and was of even a greater springboard, because then you begin to talk about, a lot of your listeners know who the Smiths are and Morrissey, and Factory Records, and the Buzzcocks were involved, and all. So that is a pretty fascinating thing.
What happened in Manchester? Kind of describe it.
The Sex Pistols did two shows. The first one was not very well put together. It was by two students that were at Bolton Academy or something like that. And they did this show.
It is like an encyclopedia.
It started.
I told you. Then the second,
your middle name's Google.
I'm on there all day.
Yeah.
Then the second time around, the Buzzcocks were on the bill. Slaughter and the Dogs were at it. And I think it's actually a really interesting thing, because it wasn't like you guys were so inspired to pick up the guitars from that. You were already a working band, and that is what is so
important,
interesting. So their perspective came from a band that had absorbed Mick Ronson, that loved Bowie, that loved all these things, and then saw this upstart, who are the Sex Pistols, whatever you were talking about, even a little about the sound check, and I think that's what's so fascinating, if you don't mind retelling.
Oh, no, not at all. But just going back to your point there, when they saw the Ramones, there's moments in musical history that define the future, yeah. And bands are formed out of that. At the Lesser Free Trade Hall, I think, you know, there's five or six bands that formed after that show.
Super important.
So we were doing the equivalent. You call them in the North, it's called the Working Man's Labor Clubs. So we were actively playing between the Frank Sinatra impersonator and the bingo. I swear to God. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they would say, we got five bandits backstage now. No, there's four of us. Okay, what's your name? Slaughter and the Dogs. The Slaughtered Dog. It really was northern town. And, you know, Wayne had green hair, I think, so, you know. But we built up a local following, and then the Sex Pistols show came around. I actually don't even know how it came about. I just know we were on the bill playing with this band from London called the Sex Pistols. But we had quite a big local following, and I think we were added to the bill to, I guess, you know, to... yeah, I'm like a homegrown band there.
Well, you guys had a following at the time, so
that's
they
right.
thought these guys will bring in people.
But
and
it was packed.
Malcolm McLaren, who was the manager, was nothing if not mercenary.
No, it was packed. I remember Paul Morley, who went on to be the... it was Neil Spencer, who was the editor of the NME, but Paul Morley is a prominent writer now. This is pre-NME. He had long hair and Hawkwind on a T-shirt, and he was like freaked out like this with his hair, because it was a big fight that night. It went off. But just going back to your story is we were watching the Sex Pistols soundcheck, and I didn't know what a phaser was on a guitar, and Steve had they started up the Chords of Anarchy, and he's doing this chug in C, And I was like, wow, this is amazing. Because it was so, and Glenn was pumping the bass. And then John had a cold, and he got these lyrics out of his pocket that had snot all over him. And, you know, and he's looking at him, and then he just spat like Richard III or something. Just demented man into Anarchy in the UK. And it was fucking mind-blowing. It was mind blowing for us.
You're good.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry, I lost myself for a moment there. But no, it was mind blowing. It really was. And, you know, we're very proud to be part of that night. And everyone was there. There was New Order in the audience.
New Order, Peter Hook, and Bernard.
Peter Hook, Tony Wilson was there. But what happened? I broke a string. Prior to us doing Suffragette City for the encore, still big Bowie fans, because I didn't have a spare guitar, but I borrowed one off a friend, and he brought the guitar back, and there was blood trickling down his head, and he'd been hit by a bottle, and we think it was one of the Pistols road crew. We don't know, but it went crazy, and there was a huge fight, and we're working class kids from Withenshaw. So who are we not to get involved?
You're not going to take any crap.
So no, we jumped in the fucking crowd and it went off. But now it's part of musical history. So we are honored and thrilled, and you know, and I give it up for the Pistols, because there was a veil on us of just trying to emulate Mick and David or whoever it was, and it just made us rethink. We were almost there. We were there in attitude, but we weren't there in direction. So it was just great, man. And a lot of bands were formed that night. Yeah. Or the germ of a band was formed, you know? Yeah.
So. Well, I'm going to... Pooch had asked me to pull some clips. I'm going to play a clip of... it's probably one of Mick Ronson's most famous, the opening of Rebel Rebel. And then I'm going to play a clip from Generation X, Valley of the Dolls, and listen to the comparison. They're quick clips. It's the opening. You'll see the influence. So here's Rebel Rebel. Okay, now here's the Generation X Valley of the Dolls. So you can catch, I think you can see the influence.
You can hear that little early Billy Idol thing there. He was the singer for Generation X.
Oh, it's just the greatness of Ronson.
Tony James, like, completely. I mean, you look at the second album there and the Droog makeup and the whole thing, and they really had that thing going on, too. So.
Well, Tony's actually, the track you played earlier, it's off a new album called Vicious, Slaughter's new album. And we're doing two nights at the 100 Club, and Tony's getting up on the Saturday night, and we're doing Ready, Steady, Go. He's a dear friend. You
can't
know?
Wait. Wow. Dream come true for me.
Yeah. Tony was on. He was here at the original show.
We're doing that in... When are we doing
February
that?
February 9th. No, 10th and 11th.
10th and 11th for February.
That's
wow. So, yeah, Tony's getting up.
At the end of the show to let people know where
it is. But I tell you, it's interesting, because at the time, Ian Hunter was producing Gen X,
right.
And Mick Ronson was producing the Rich Kids.
Wow. Yeah, which I love that.
Of
record.
Course, yeah.
And I found out later, Mick took a lot of heat because people thought, well, the production wasn't that good. And you realize it's more of the mastering, because when you hear it remixed, you hear how good that production is.
I love
the Rich Kids.
The Heartbreakers suffered from the same thing. The actual album was great. It's mastering is as important as you know, you like signing off on a track. And then when you give it to some fucking Muppet who doesn't know what he's doing, who has nothing invested in it.
It's true. Who's watching the needles.
Yeah.
And then exactly.
No, it's really... I mean, when we opened the show, Jeff played... it was said that I was... I'm in a band called The Glorious, which I produced. I mean, Slaughter the Dogs is the main band.
Right.
But The Glorious, we got Owen Morris, who produced Oasis and The Verve and Madness and Smith. He's a mad Welshman. But he mixed the album for me, but he also mastered it. And it's so important.
Well, let me play a clip of that real quick since you're talking about it. Which one do you want me to play? Dancing Angels, Pain, or Windsor's Tale?
Play a...
Because I pulled the leads.
Oh, play a Pain.
Okay, let me grab that here and take a listen to this one. This is... all this stuff is great. Some great guitars. Now, where did I put it? Oh, there it is. Here we go. Everybody, I recommend when you listen again to this show, listen to it in headphones so you hear what's going on in there. I notice, is that a, I have to talk gear real quick and interject, then we'll talk about the whole thing behind it. But is that a regular Vauxhall or a Crybaby, or is that still the color sound?
That was the color sound.
Yeah, cool.
Wow.
And what I wanted to do with that is I tried to do a solo where it was minimal notes. And so if you listen to that and break it down, it is, I try and sustain a note through eight bars.
Yeah.
And so it's done the first eight bars. It's one note sustained. And then I go up to the high octave, and it's the same thing, just sustained. And that's what I was going for. Because years ago, Ian Hunter said to me, he said, it's what you leave out that's important. And I didn't know what he meant because I was a kid. I was just a mad fan of, and it was when Ian was playing with Mick, and I knew Mick, and he said, "It's what you leave out," and I didn't get it until
You can get that sound when you listen to the famous Santa Monica Civic and Ronson. And what I really appreciate that more than the studio records with Visconti.
Yeah, you did right, man.
He did some of those orchestral things mm-hmm. on guitar.
Yeah.
And you're right, he just let that thing just hang in there and you felt so much coming off that.
And it's the vibrato.
It was one song nobody's addressed, because Width of a Circle.
Oh,
remember
man.
That song?
Oh,
now that's where he finally does an extended solo, which goes on for 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And you can hear all that. See, one thing about Ronson, too, is when I first heard him, it was the parts he wrote.
Yeah.
He was a pop writer,
right.
And his guitar lines, because he always felt like he was holding back. And then that live show, when you saw it, especially that song, which is a brilliant song nobody even knows, or Superman, which is another great
that's
one.
Well, man,
but all those, but that's even got a punk thing to it, Width of a Circle. It's got that drive. It's got crazy stuff. So that, I recommend that as a good lesson of
That clip that we just played, you can, even though you're not playing a lot of notes and stuff, there's passion. You can feel feel.
Yeah.
I mean, it's intense, and that intensity comes across. On this side of the pond, the saying used to be, less is more. That was...
Yeah. For bass players.
But I think it's...
dictators who said, you know, quantity is quality.
Less is more. Forget about pitch. Just sing the song.
But it's going back to what we said right at the beginning is... If you mean it, somehow it picks up if you feel it.
Yeah.
And you don't have to be the greatest technician in the world. So, you know, and just going back, is that was mixed and mastered by Owen Morris. And, and so mastering is like when Mick Ronson produced The Rich Kids, it had kind of a woolly sound.
Yeah.
But it's not a true representation of what this sound, because you know, Mick's a great producer.
Oh yeah.
So mastering is equally as important. So anybody who can follow a record through, please, you know, take the time to speak to the guy who's mastering it. try and get him emotionally involved or invested in it. Sure. And it's
or
not just
go in, you know,
even better.
Whenever we master anything, we go into the studio and we sit there with them.
Yeah.
Because,
yeah.
Yeah, man, you just can't.
Yeah.
It comes back and it's like, what what happened
what
to my record?
Do?
Yeah.
Well, just like when you go into a session, when I would go into a session and we'd meet, and if I was producing and I was meeting with the engineer, I'd bring a bunch of records in and this is what I like.
This is the sound, yeah. Sure.
Because they're trying to figure that out really fast. And and you know, the money, you know, you're on the clock.
Sure.
So the more that you can, and they'll usually meet with you beforehand and go through it, then they're more comfortable because they understand what you're looking for. Because
right.
they're there to try to get what you want. But it's sometimes if you don't give them the information, it's kind of hard. And then you know,
well,
you
that
don't
was that was the thing back then, you know, with who print, because with vinyl, that was the most critical point of it, the mastering and getting it. And some if you had a good budget, then you may have two or three samples. But then some record, it's good enough, we'll put it out.
But
and then you were stuck with it.
But like this cut that we were playing, where you have a bunch of distorted guitars playing rhythm, and then you have your lead, and then there's some, I don't know if that was keyboard or something.
Yeah, there's a string movement underneath.
There is strings.
But what Owen Morris said to me when he mastered, because the first Oasis album, they tried to do it themselves, and then Noel tried to produce it, and it wasn't happening. So Alan McGee says, I'm going to bring this guy in called Owen Morris. And Owen was working for Johnny Marr at the time. And what Owen did, he says he mastered the record twice as loud as one would normally master a record. And even Johnny Marr was like, you're fucking nuts, you can't do that. And Owen's a mad Welshman. And he says, I can, and I will, because he used these compressors. And then what happened is, anytime an Oasis record came on a jukebox, it was three times louder than anything else.
Yeah.
And without Owen, he broke Oasis and gave them, because they were nicknamed the Sex Beatles, because of the melody from Noel and the aggression.
Sure.
But it was Owen who gave him that crunch. You know,
but on your record, you can hear you can still hear all the parts. And that's not easy when you have a bunch of guitars fully blown out.
Yeah.
That it gets mushy real fast.
It's true, it gets muddy. Yeah, you're right.
And you can hear it. That's the genius.
Yeah,
I mean, that's that's part of what the mastering. You can hear it's just clean. It's it's clear.
But that's to me something so important about really good music is you can listen to it over and over and over and get things out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And when it's clean like that, you can hear all the parts and things. You know, I mean, it sounded great.
There's just something great, you know, even when I was a kid and you'd put headphones on and you'd listen to a hunky-dory, and then right at the end you'd hear, you know, the phone ring and a little bit of talking. or, you know, when you got a good set of headphones, you start to hear things that you didn't hear on the $3 record player you had, you know?
Well, I think you felt that when you heard I'm a Walrus, too. There was all kind of stuff going on, starting way back then.
Oh, yeah.
Which birthed Jeff Lynne, obviously.
He's a genius.
Yeah. And I did see, when I lived in London, I did see the Move.
Oh, wow. Nice. With Roy Wood, too?
Roy Wood. Yeah. Now, there was some crazy.
That's incredible.
Yeah. Some crazy. It wasn't pop music. There was some crazy shit.
They had that edge to them.
Now, I'm going to play another thing, a couple of clips of the same song. This is The Who's So Sad About Us. And then I have a clip of The Jam playing it.
Oh, okay.
So, and then I want you guys to respond to that because it's an it's an interesting to see the similarities and the differences. Here's The Who first. Now, that was live, I think that was 67, and it was some BBC show. It was on BBC. Now, here's The Jam, So Sad About Us. We'll be right back. Now that's just interesting. Sounds like they had a double shot of caffeine there, and it just like kicked. No, but you can see the
Cone Foxton was great though. Yeah.
Well, it's like, you know, you're emulating your heroes, you know.
It's true.
So.
And you pick your good ones.
Yeah.
Of course.
You know.
We did covers too like that. You know, you do it at your own speed.
Yeah.
Tempo-wise or vibe, you know.
Well, you know, sometimes as well, you don't intend to go out and nick something. Maybe subconsciously, it just, you know, that resonate, and you know, you, oh fuck, that sounds like that. But you know, like we were talking very earlier on, is you start somewhere, and someone helps form you, an influence or a band, and I know Paul Weller was mad into the Who.
Oh yeah,
way
oh, yeah.
You know, and the small faces.
Oh, yeah.
In fact, I remember seeing Paul and Townsend on the front of NME. And it was the old school meet the new school.
Yeah, with Rex, right?
Yeah,
with the Rex. Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah.
Well, wasn't there two? There were in England, and correct me if I'm wrong. Wasn't there two groups at the in around the time of the Who was forming? There were the Mods and the Rockers, right?
That's right. The Mods and the Rockers. Yeah.
The Who was the Mods, right?
Who was the Mods?
Who were the Rockers?
You know, it's a good question. Because I remember Quadrophenia. There was the Mods and the Rockers.
Yeah, exactly.
They were called Greasers.
Would that be Johnny Kidd?
And then the Beatles pirates. Said they were yeah. mockers. That was yeah. the, that was
Which
the
is a great line.
No,
yeah.
I remember some. Yeah,
but who were the Rockers? Who were they? I mean,
a lot of rockabilly kind of guys.
Because I don't think it was like the Stones or something like that.
No. It depends where you live.
So would it, was it like the Teddy Boy? It would be the Teddy Boys, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Or the post skiffle like Lonnie Donegan,
Billy J. Kramer,
Johnny and the Hurricanes.
Right, Hurricanes. Yeah.
Anyone who wore leather.
But the Mods are better dancers.
Cliff Richard.
Yeah, I'm better dressed. Yeah.
Cliff Richard was posh.
They had better drugs, too.
Now, let me ask you this. Was blues a big part of it or not?
Yeah, very much so. I remember we played a Wigan Casino back in the day, and we would we'd do the show. It was a big place we played. When we finished the gig, there'd be a line around the block of these people with overnight bags, all Mods in their suits, and it was Northern Soul.
Oh,
and
wow.
they would come in at midnight and get blued up, blues, which is amphetamine, and just dance their asses
all
off.
Night, yeah.
Yeah. But it was a certain, you know, it just didn't seem seedy to me because it was cool. They had great suits on, great music. And these all they were doing were dancing.
Yeah.
But their blues were a big part, man.
Yeah.
Big part.
So who were the blues influences to you? Were you like, were you influenced similar like the Stones, where they were looking at the American black blues musicians and stuff? Or were you like second generation? Was it the Stones that influenced?
The Stones, yeah.
Clapton.
Yeah. I mean, again, you know, working class upbringing. I think we had three TV channels. Mm. And so magazines like Cream or Rolling Stone, they were exotic. You know,
right.
They didn't come into our area. You had to seek them out, you know.
Same way with us with NME and Sounds.
Right.
Those things.
So you got what was prominent, which was the Stones, the Who, you know, all those giants. So, and
let's not forget the Kinks, who were pretty pre-punk.
Yes.
Yeah.
And they were pretty rowdy live.
Waterloo Sunset, one of the greatest songs
ever
written.
Let alone, you know, we did a cover of The Hard Way.
Yeah, you did.
On our second album, but we did it punk.
Yeah.
Kind of faster speed. Kinks were punk.
Right.
I mean, not only they beat each other up, but his writing, he was still one of the most unsung writers.
Oh, yeah.
It's
Ray
funny,
Davis.
Though, isn't it, about brothers? If you look at the Black Crowes,
right.
Same thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Oasis,
the same thing.
Now look at Hart Sisters. They kept together a little better.
Yeah.
Dave and Ray.
That's girl power.
Dave
women
and
do it better.
So I have a thought, like you're talking about from the beginning of this. I'm actually curious from Mick about the end of it all, because now you're talking the Sex Pistols lasted really about two and a half years.
Yeah.
The Clash with the original lineup only lasted to 82.
Yeah.
Then you talk about all these other Stranglers, Adverts, the second generation, XTC. So there were all these different bands. That when it all kind of came crashing down, did you look at it and go, oh my God, this is crazy, or this has really run its course? I'm curious what your perspective was when, because you could say that it probably really kind of ran out of steam around, besides the Clash, like 79, 80, New Wave came
That's
in.
That's when we fucked it all up.
It's a really good...
Power pop. Skinny tie power pop.
Fucked it all up.
No, it's a really good question.
What was your perspective on that?
My perspective is we were still all relatively young, and everything was moving so fast. You know, and then we discovered drugs and speed and, you know... and so you would just go with the flow. So when it came to an end for Slaughter, I think I, because I played with a lady called Pearl Harbor,
sure, of course,
and the Explosions. She was dating Paul Simon at the time. Yeah. So I kind of leapfrogged from that, and then I went and did some stuff with Talk Talk. You know the band Talk
right,
Talk,
right.
Oh, yeah.
Sure.
And then from Talk Talk, I went to play with a guy called Pete Wiley, right, who had the Pete Mighty Y had the Story of the Blues, and right. So it was all, you didn't really stop to take stock of it. It just was like, okay, it's kind of running its course, and we'll you know, I'll go and do that now, and I'll go. And then I went out with a band called One the Juggler, who Mick had produced, and Mick was meant to do the tour with them, but he couldn't because he was producing Bonnie. What was that? Bonnie something. She had Bonnie Raitt. Lady, English lady. Total Eclipse of the Heart.
Bonnie,
oh, yeah.
Bonnie Tyler.
Yeah.
It's a heartache.
Jim Steinman.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I you didn't really take stock of it. Well, I didn't. So it was just because everything was moving fast, and it was like, okay, this is how I think I can earn a living. So you would just go from one to the other to the other. So you didn't really take, because you're always looking to pay the rent or the next gig. So later on, when you get older, you kind of reflect on it and see the mistakes one made.
But you pick good people, though.
Excuse me?
You pick good people to play with, too.
Oh, no, I was lucky. I was lucky, man. Yeah.
But you were evolving, too. So you're, exactly. You were changing because you're out there touring with all these bands, so you're getting influenced by all of them, plus whatever else you were hearing. You change. It's just a natural
part of it.
It's not that it stopped. It's just it evolved.
Exactly.
And for the very small group of fanatics that are out there that may or may not listen to the song, because this is probably a topic that doesn't get covered on this show a little bit, I went to college in 86. When I was listening to R.E.M. and Hendrix records and Grateful Dead, pretty much everybody I know was listening to the Smiths.
Oh, yeah.
And the Morrissey was actually at that Manchester Hall. And then because he's part of that group, because, I mean, you're talking, Manchester has an incredible legacy of groups, yourself included, and then, you know, Liam Stone Roses. Peter Noon.
Peter Noon,
So you had a little encounter with Morrissey.
Well, did, yeah. Well, because I knew Johnny pre-Smiths, you know.
He's an amazing guitar player, amazing texturalist, really incredible.
He's great, yeah. You know, and a nice dude, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, he's just brilliant. So, after Slaughter, then I did some stuff with a producer called Vic Mayo, who produced Tom Robinson, Motorway hit, right?
Right.
And so... and then I knew Billy Duffy was a friend. So
from the Cult. Yep.
Yeah. And then we did it. We cut some tracks with a band called Studio Sweethearts. But prior to that, Billy had said, I know this singer called Steven. You know, he's mad into the Dolls. I'm like, cool, you know, because the Dolls were great, you know, trashy and brilliant. And so we had some rehearsals with it was me... It was Phil Rowland on drums and Howard, the original Slaughter bass player, and Billy Duffy.
Wow.
Morrissey, and his lyrics were just incredible, but he was so introvert, and he was very, very shy. You know, you're looking for David Johansen, or that's what you want to see, the British version of that, you know, or Iggy, you know. Mm. You know, there was... few studio sessions and a little bit of writing going back and forth, and then kind of moved on foolishly. Yeah. Hey, you know what? It's meant to be. Morris is You know, he's an amazing, he's a one-off. And
did you happen to see Joy Division during that time as well?
Yeah, yeah, we knew all those guys. There was one big rehearsal room in Manchester. It was run by a guy called T.J. Davidson, and his dad made a lot of dough out of jewelry and diamonds. So he bought his son this building, and it was actually across the road from where the Hacienda became. Right. And so we all would rehearse there. You'd see Joy Division, you'd see Howard DeVoto, then he went on to Magazine.
Elvis Costello?
No, not Elvis Costello, he wasn't there. But I never could understand. I remember, I don't know if I should tell this story. Oh, fuck it, yeah. I remember Peter Hook, and he'd come in from... He'd come in from whatever job he had and put on his punk clothes to rehearse. I was like, that's a bit weird, you know. Because we, you know, we dressed how you dress. We poor, you know. But he would take the tie off and then put something else on.
Well, it's almost like bellboy, right?
Yeah, right? Yeah, yeah.
He got his day gig and he goes and dresses up with the mods and all.
But Joy Division would be rehearsing in one room. We'd be there in another. And Simply Red were even there, but they were called Frantic Elevators before then. Oh. So it was Mick Hucknall. It was like the epicenter of all these bands that were, you know, this was the place to rehearse. It was affordable. So you cross paths with all of them, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But we were arrogant little bastards, you know? Honest, we were. We didn't... We weren't... We could have been nicer, I think.
That's so funny you say that. This is like a third-hand thing, but a friend of mine is a huge Cult fan.
Yeah.
And he met, I guess, Billy and
Ian.
Ian, yeah. Right. And he heard from some other fan, they were like, wow, I saw you guys... 20 years ago, it's so great to see you, and they were so warm and wonderful, yeah. And that same fan was, man, you guys were jerks when you said, and they were like, yeah, it was different times. And if you stay in this game long enough, it humbles all of us in different ways.
It's just, I don't know what it is, whether it's just this you're young and your ego and, you know, all of that nonsense.
Yeah, but it's a gang ego, because basically a lot of the music came from the culture. And a lot of it was rebellion against something.
Yeah.
So I think when we had our little groups, it was a gang. I mean, I had gangs when I grew up in Brooklyn, so I kind of know the feeling. So even if we were assholes, we were protecting our gang.
It's true. Mm. It's a good get-out-of-jail card, I'll tell you.
Yeah.
I remember once we were playing the Roundhouse, and Dire Straits were supporting us, and they came and says, can we use your drum riser? And I said, ask the drummer. So they went over to the drummer and says, can we use your drum riser? He went... Fuck off.
Right.
Not me, by the way. The other guy. Yeah.
Well, we had a...
Oh, my
but
God.
But why? You know,
so we had to learn that. I mean, then that came out in 78, but between... I lived in England 73 to 75. So the way that, like we were talking about, music evolving. When we first started, Doug had a Johnny Rotten fetish. One of the songs we did, I wish you could play it, called Art War.
Right.
Where it is really sounds like a punk band.
Right.
And we were like power punk pop, because we all love The Who. We were not the Beatles. Right. And the rhythm section was, you know, it was what it was. But we played a couple of punk places in Friars Club in Aylesbury.
Yeah.
And we played the Marquee, the Aylesbury Club. Nobody told us that the punk audience in 78, how they react.
Oh. And that's a terrible way to find
so
out.
So after the first song, things start coming our way. Nicked chillings with cuts and beer cans. And
he's not talking ladies' panties.
No, I'm definitely not. Yeah. So that was a shocking... I still have a button and the ticket from that place. Yeah. It was one of those nights. So next, we got through it. Then we played the Marquee Club, but the interesting was Scotland had played England, and England lost. So we're in that, you know, water through whatever, and people were pissed and drunk. So we're playing the Marquee Club. It was a punk audience.
Oh, man. Here
so
we go.
Three, 4 songs in, people start luging. Yeah. Doug says, fuck off. Next thing you know is Doug kicks the guy, and there's an all-out war. Right. We weren't even a punk band, but we still protected each other like we were. Yeah. But you know what it's like down in London. When you London loses in a big soccer game, people are freaking miserable.
Anywhere in England.
But I got a taste of that. And the thing about the Knack was, in the beginning, we were more like we're playing eighth note music. A lot of the songs are fast. They're driving.
Well, Let Me Out is fantastic.
So we Let Me Out's really gone, Let Me the Hell Out of This.
Well, a lot of your live stuff, it's much more
Let Me Out of This Thing.
Mm-hmm. And of course, Doug's coming from Detroit. You know,
so he got out, though. Funny thing, Mark Bell, who replaced the Ramones, I played in the band with him when I was 18 and 19 in Brooklyn.
Oh, wow.
To see Mark become that, I was like, pretty cool.
Right on.
I would have never known. Okay. But all these, groups become legends over time. And when you see a group, the Who were different to me because nobody, I don't know when you first saw them, but I saw them Fillmore when I was like 16. And Moon was Moon. And
well, you saw him the first tours.
Yeah, I saw him all the way through Woodstock. I saw him at Fillmore a lot. I saw the Tommy. I saw actually the Earl's Court when they played Quadrophenia, they debuted it. But when Moon was, they were really the first punk band. The attitude-wise, the thing of fuck off if you're not with us. Mm-hmm. But his guitar playing, and nobody can ever play like Moon. And
he's a great
or act like
he would. Yeah, that's true. But he would go everywhere, and he always got back to one. Something's going to happen.
Yeah.
He's going to miss it. He got it.
And you see that there. Growing up in some of the groups that really. I saw the Crazy World of Arthur Brown.
Wow! Wow!
This crazy guy's doing this thing on stage, coming out.
He had a Bunsen burner on his head.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So you see all the theater, but you see the great bands like Humble Pie earlier on. But it's still the same rock. It's still the same amps, the same guitars. It's just redefining what the culture is and whether you're angry or not angry. But a lot of great music
and it reflects,
came from anger.
And it reflects the time.
Exactly.
And the cultural atmosphere of the time.
Now, when I left London, London was going to crap because when I was living there, they had this big strike where everything was shut down, the rails, there was no oil coming.
That's Margaret Thatcher for you.
What a lady.
What a lady. Salt of the earth.
But funny enough.
Not.
And I saw it.
Thank God that'll never happen again.
No. But we got something else going on, a big Bunsen burner here.
Yeah.
But seeing the groups like the reggae movement started, the Speakeasy, which I went to a lot. I actually saw Michael's band, the Heavy Metal Kids.
I did an album with Gary.
Did you? Yeah. Okay. So I saw the changes,
We ended up in Pete Townsend's kitchen by mistake in Richmond, seriously.
That's a good story.
Because I did an album with Gary Holt. After the Heavy Metal Kids, Gary and I became friends. And it was, it was after Slaughter, obviously. So we did an album together, and we recorded it in Norway. And then we were going to, we were in Richmond, and we were going to Ronnie Wood's house to see.
I love that. The Wick.
Yeah, right?
The most beautiful house ever.
And so we've got the directions, and this is a true story. And in Richmond, there's these canals. It's beautiful. And so Gary and I, we're walking, and we said, well, it must be this one and that one. Anyway, we go in the back way, and the doors open, and it's a kitchen open. We're like, we just go in and sit down. And then Pete Townsend comes in and goes, yeah? And he knew Gary. He didn't know who I was, but he knew Gary. And he's like, we've come to see Ronnie. And he's like, no, this is my house. First time I met Pete Townsend. Swear to God, true story.
Well, we're out of time. I know. So this has to be continued. You guys have to come back. I just want to mention really quick, I want to get through Pat DiPuccio, www.condors.com, right?
The Condors.com.
And
not to be confused with the Condoms.
Right. Okay, that's right.
They were another group.
Or the Commodores.
For you, Prescott, www.thenack.com.
Well, that's part of it. You can find me on Facebook.
They're on Facebook.
I'm in civilian clothes.
And Mick is both The Glorious and Slaughter and the Dogs. These albums that you guys brought over, where can they get these?
Well, the Slaughter and the Dogs one is our new album called Vicious, and it was out a few months ago. You can get that anywhere now, I guess. And the Glorious one is not out yet. It's about to come out, the one that Owen mixed. But Mark and I are about to go on a 2-month European tour starting in February, right? To promote Vicious. So.
Oh, very cool.
The band website's satd.band.
Okay, satd.band. And then you guys are working on a new album, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So we got to get you back to talk about the new album.
Oh, we would love to, Jeff. It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Now, before we go,
can we destroy the studio now?
Yeah. Before you destroy the studio, I have a special cut of the Condors from their upcoming album. So just set it up. It's a really cool song.
It's an instrumental cut, and the next record that we're doing is going to be a 6-song EP of songs my old band Blow Up did. That I never thought the songs got produced right or anything like that. So I'm going and taking time, getting it done. I'm singing it, and these are songs that never really came out. And this is an instrumental cut.
It's called
High Chaparral.
Thank you guys so much for being here. We're going to do this again. And everybody have a great week. This is High Chaparral. This is a very you'll love this. This is very good.
Share it.